Okay.
Well, we have really tightened this thing up, haven't we?
Yeah, I'm not letting those senators come.
We got enough room to not sit quite that close together, don't we?
Do you mind still perfect?
Yeah.
Sorry.
The interim House Interim Committee on Revenue will come to order for our May 23rd meeting. Colleagues, we have a long information meeting today, and I'd like to just get right into it. Our first presentation is a description and analysis of Initiative Petition 28 by the Legislative Revenue Office. Paul and Chris.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. But before we get into the report, I do want to mention another report out on OLAS for you, which is our revenue measures passed, which for the 16 session. And so that's just what we follow up each session with that summary. So we put that together shortly after the short session, and we haven't had a chance to meet with you since. So just let you know that's out there. And it summarizes all the bills that were revenue bills that were approved during the February session. So light reading. So today we want to walk through with you today description and analysis of IP 28. You'll find the report itself, research report number 316, and OLAS, and also I'm going to walk through the PowerPoint presentation with you. Just a couple of things about our process. It was really three of us who put a lot of time in on this since the February session. Chris went through very thoroughly the 2013 corporate tax returns, and you'll see that data. Last time we had talked to you and done preliminary estimates, the latest we have is 2012. Chris was able to look through those through our statutory authority, able to look at individual corporate returns. But just to remind you that we are subject to the disclosure laws, the same as Department of Revenue, so we're not able to reveal individual company names to you. We could ask that a lot, but we cannot do that. It's a felony if we do. And then also, so Chris put a lot of time in that, a lot of thinking, and so we've been really thanked the work he's done. The other person that was did a lot of work with us is Ed Waters. There's no one here that was around in 01, but Ed was with Legislative Revenue Office about 6 years, late 90s, early 2000s. He was really the project manager for OTIM, our Oregon Tax Incidence Model. He had, for his doctoral dissertation, he did a CGE model of the Oregon economy. So he's been steeped in this stuff for a very long time, and he came back, helped us update the model in the fall. and also worked with us very closely on developing this analysis. So I want to especially thank Ed for that. We also got some good feedback from three anonymous reviewers, and I just want to appreciate them publicly without revealing who they are. We've built in a number of those comments from them. So our intent here is to give you an objective, balanced analysis based on the tools we have, based on the understanding of tax analysis from the public finance community, and we think we've given you a good report to start this discussion. We're under no delusions. We know this is not going to be the final word. There's going to be some things we overemphasized or underemphasized depending on your perspective. So we perfectly are prepared for that. And what we hope to do is to work with you further to develop the analysis. And one thing I'm thinking about doing in a few months' time is to put together a frequently asked questions kind of document for you so you can have something directly that relates to questions you may be getting from constituents. So all of that preliminary aside, let me get into the report. These are the elements of it. We did get a number of questions from members about, well, how does this thing work? How does the mechanics work? One thing it doesn't do is it does not repeal the basic corporate tax rates, the 6.6 and 7.6 rates based on net income. So it affects the corporate minimum, but it keeps in place this comparison that corporations have to make, basically doing two calculations, one on rates, one on the minimum, and paying the higher of the two. It changes the equation a lot, but that same preparation that has to be done. We'll look at some hypothetical examples that will show that. We have the 2013 corporate tax data. You'll be able to see corporate sales by industry and by size of corporation to see those that are initially affected. You'll see there's a wide variation by industry, and we'll talk a lot more about that as we get into the analysis. We wanted to look at the overall impact of Oregon's relative tax burden, which gives you a sense of the magnitude, how this would affect us relative to other states. We did it both in terms of business taxes and in terms of overall state and local taxes. Looked a bit at gross receipts tax. The corporate minimum is a gross receipts base. So some of the implications of going to that base, it does lead to some pretty significant changes in your tax structure and the mix of taxes you have at the state level. It's something I know this committee has talked about a lot in the past. Then we get into the economic effects through our simulations. We have produced distribution effects based on our household groupings and our simulation models. And then we'll provide you with some updated revenue impact estimates. We try to build in some secondary effects, not only economic effects, but also some what we're calling tax planning effects, which we would anticipate given that this the tax base is not is narrow enough that a lot of individual entities will not be subject to it directly. And then, of course, with a tax change of this magnitude and the concentrated impact, there's definitely uncertainties. We'll go through those. We recognize those are significant and want to make sure you're aware of those. And we've thought about these, but there's just no way to eliminate them going into it. So the description, most of you, I think, are pretty familiar with what IP 28 would do. It is... those of you here in 2009 remember House Bill 3405, which was Measure 67. There was a lot of work done on what is the appropriate corporate minimum base. Remember, we had a $10 flat fee and then went to a base. We looked at different options. We looked at things like value added, for example. But ultimately, the legislature settled on a discrete categories of Oregon sales as the basis for the corporate minimum. Of course, that corporate minimum, you would go from a flat amount up to, if your Oregon sales were above $100 million, you'd pay up to $100,000 as a minimum tax. So what IP 28 does, it maintains those corporate income tax definitions. It doesn't change any of that. It doesn't change the definition of Oregon sales. Those all stay in place. It establishes a new marginal rate of 2.5%. For Oregon sales in excess of $25 million. So obviously the first step in this analysis is to look who these guys are. And we can do that pretty directly through our corporate tax returns. It applies only to C corporations. So, and again, remember the discussion you had around the minimum. The decision was to make just $150 flat amount for S corporations, partnerships, and use those. They would not be subject to those scaled minimum based on sales. So that doesn't, this doesn't change that. Benefit corporations or benefit companies, really more appropriately, are exempt from this. Benefit companies were created in 2011. There's a process by which companies have to go through to get this designation, be registered with Secretary of State. Now it's about 750 of them. Just perusing the list, they look to be relatively small companies. I don't see the big name companies. Of course, now there's no tax advantage to being a benefit company, so that's something that could well change. Of course, if this were to come into play, where you'd have potentially some significant tax savings if you're able to be designated a benefit company. The measure first applies to the 17 corporate tax year. That means you're going to get, if it passes, you're going to get revenue this biennium. And it's going to be corporate revenue, which probably means you're going to get a big kicker, which, of course, will go into the state school or go to the general fund for purposes of K-12 funding under the Constitution. And finally, there is a designation, kind of general designation around early childhood education, K-12, healthcare, and services for seniors in the initiative, where those dollars would be spent roughly general fund, but not exempt. So one of the things that we've talked about and had spent some time on in this committee is over the implications of the definition for Oregon sales, which again is current law. For a tangible goods producer, the Oregon sale is determined by the location of the customer. So if you're an Oregon company, you have your customer in Idaho, you sell product to them, ship it to Idaho, it's not an Oregon sale. It's the location of the customer. One area where you do have some feedback effects is through the corporate nexus. If you're a producer and a company that sells into a state that cannot tax you because you don't have sufficient nexus there. There's specific corporate nexus standards that are different than sales tax or other nexus standards. And they cannot tax you. Not that they don't tax you, but they cannot tax you. Then that sale gets thrown back to Oregon. So if you're a small exporter, you sell into Idaho, Idaho can't tax you. That sale comes back to Oregon. It's thrown back to Oregon, becomes an Oregon sale. So just that's a reminder that that's part of that Oregon sales definition in the current law. Now, the service producers operate with different guidelines through the cost performance methodology. It is not where the customer is located, but where the service is performed. So if you're a service a company and you're, say, an accounting firm or a marketing firm, and you're performing that service in Oregon and your customer is Illinois, it doesn't matter. That counts as an Oregon sale in terms of the cost performance methodology. There's another step to this, though, and that is that if it's all allocated to one state, so if it's in the plurality of where the service is performed. So if you perform 40% of your service in Idaho and 30% in Oregon and 20% in other states, all of it would go to Idaho under the cost of performance. So there's no proportioning out as there is with the tangible property. So that could be significant for those firms that use the cost of performance methodology. So for example, if you're a corporation and you sell into Oregon and you operate under the cost of performance, you perform all your service in New York, you're not affected one way or the other by this because it's not Oregon sales. So that's something that to think through as you look at some of the potential impacts on the different sectors. Okay, there's some hypothetical corporations. The first chart is pretty straightforward here, just showing that we have a lot of individual businesses that will not be affected directly by this. If you're an S-corp, you're not affected by this. We did, by the way, look at the number of S-corps that have sales over 25 million. It was about 500. So there are a lot of S-corps that are over that threshold but are not subject to this because they're not C-corps. C-corporation with sales of 6 million, where they're going to pay 4,000 today, and they would pay 4,000 under the initiative if it became law because they're below 25 million. And the same is true of the third row there, 15,000 was what they would pay under the current table, and that would not change. Where you start to see changes are the, in the fourth row, where a C corp is sales of 70 million, and then their minimum would go from 50,000 to about 1.15 million. So because that amount above 25 million up to 70 million would be subject to the 2.5% rate, marginal rate. The C corp with 150 million, you can see has an increase of about 3 million, and for the big corporation at 350, it's about 8 million. Now keep in mind, these are all guys that are just paying the minimum now, so we're only looking at the minimum, one part of the equation. It does interact with the rates, so you're going to have corporations moving from rates to the minimum based on the change. And that's really the key element here, the change in the corporate income tax structure. Hypothetical company A has 20 million in sales. They have 4 million income. They're paying based on income. They'll continue to. So that's not going to change. And those are the people that will continue to pay based on rates. Now, hypothetical corporation B has 60 million in sales. And it has 3 million in net income, so it pays 218,000. That's taking 6.6% of its first million and 7.6% of its next 2 million. That's where you get the 218. Well, under IP 28, they would be paying 2.5% of those sales above 25 million, so they're at about 900,000, and they would be paying the minimum. So they calculate the rate, then they say, well, the minimum's higher now, so that's what we'll pay. So we think there's about 400 corporations, we can tell based on the data, that would move from rate payer to minimum payer under this. Hypothetical corporation C is one with very high profits, 18 million on 60 million in sales. They pay about 1.4 million through the sales or through the net income, and that would stay the same. So they would continue to pay based on rates. So you're always going to see some corporations like that. And you'll see some that'll move back and forth, going paying through the rates in profitable years and through the minimum on less profitable years. If you look at example D, you can see another example of a corporation that's going from paying based on 6 million in net income to paying based on sales for the minimum tax. Corporations E and F both have the same level of sales. They would both be paying the same under the minimum, 4.4 million, but the more profitable company would be getting a smaller increase because they're paying more now because they have 30 million in profits versus 15 million. So you're going to see corporations are going to be affected by these different examples, and you know, you can do a lot of real detailed analysis based on the different characteristics. So now, if we look at the data we have for 2013 and just look at how it would be distributed, the first big change is these 28,000 C corps. Now, these are not—we're not talking S corps or partnerships or anything. We're talking just about C corps. 28,000 of them have less than 25 million in Oregon sales. So now they're paying about a quarter of the corporate income tax, which is 461 million for 2013 liability. That's C corps only. They would pay the same because they're not affected, leaving 4.4% of the new much higher total. So their taxes would stay the same, but their proportion of corporate taxes would go way down. And that would end up being paid by the corporations in these different categories. And of course, you get up over 100 million, you see that they go from 74 million to 546 million, the 168 corporations in that category. And those over 250, 106 corporations would go from 139 million to about 1.7 billion, and from 30% of the total, 60%. So if you look at these top two groups, they go from 46% of the corporate tax at 461 to 79%. And the big change is around paying the minimum versus based on the rates. If you look at current law, these current law estimates, 91% of the revenue, 91% of that 461 million comes from rates, 9% from the minimum. Of that 2.9 billion calculation under IP 28, 94% of that revenue comes from the minimum, 6% from the rates. So the big picture revenue policy, tax policy decision here is you're changing this base from a one based on net income to largely one based on gross receipts or organ sales. So that's a significant policy decision. Even when you ignore the magnitude of the change, the switch in those proportions is significant. And we'll look at some of the implications of that. The next major input we have is from the effects on different industries. And so you break them up now at the 461, again, broken down by industry group, and collapsed a few of these. We've got a few more additional ones. I think we've got 19 total. That would go to everybody. All of these sectors would get an increase as you go from 461 to 2.9 billion, but some would get an increase in the proportion of that last column. Those are the ones I put in red. And the first one you see is utilities. They would go from less than a million to 104 million and would go up to 3.6% of the corporate minimum based on those 13 tax returns. The other two sectors that are very much affected are wholesale trade and retail trade. And you can see that together they constitute about 45% of the new base, 37% of the old base. So their share is going up, and when you add those together, along with the management sector, you get well over half the new base. And the management companies, where you can see they go up to 10.6% to 13, that's very much a conglomerate of different final products. It's holding companies primarily, is what it is. So the management companies where corporations holding other corporations. They can be corporate offices within it, but they are managing other corporations. So it's hard to be precise what their final economic function is or what their market is. The healthcare is another one that goes from 7.9 to 103 million. And we think a lot of that is due to the pharmaceutical industry that has high gross receipts within that sector. They've given us some data to indicate that. So you can see how this shifts by industry. You know, this plays a big part of how we're modeling this, so I'll talk about that. The first thing we wanted to do is get a macro sense of what's the big picture in terms of the magnitude of the increase. And we've talked with this committee before, and when we went through the tax reform options, we used the cost study, Council of State Taxation Business Tax Study. It has some critics, but I think it's pretty well put together. It's an annual study that looks at all taxes that are initially paid by business. And the biggest is property taxes. The second biggest is sales taxes on business purchases. The third is corporate income. So the way COST treats corporate income is they include these taxes that are based on gross receipts. So they put the Ohio CAT, the Washington B&O, and the Texas margin tax all into that corporate sector. Into their corporate taxes. So that shows up as business taxes directly. And you can see what it does is it increases our tax burden from 4.1 to 5.6% of income. One of the things we did is, if you look at the cost study, if you've gone through that, they do this business calculation as a percent of gross state product in the private sector, and that's not something we use in any other comparison. So we converted this to personal income, a broader measure. So this is business taxes as a share of income in the state. So you won't see that 4.1%. You'll see a different number in the cost study, but the 6.3 billion, which came from the cost study, is the basis of it. That 6.3 goes up to 8.6 billion. And that pushes us up to 5.6% of income. Washington is at 5.9, so we'd still be below Washington. California's at 4.7, Idaho at 4.2, and the national average is at 4.9%. So we would go above the national average and above Idaho and California, but remain below Washington, which of course has both a retail sales tax and a business and occupation tax. Now, if you look at overall taxes and look at the census data, and this is one different year, 12-13, to get all the state and local government data in, you can see that the taxes on a per capita basis go up by about 600. So that's just taking that in, that IP 28 initial estimate and superimposing it on the 12-13 data. The rank among the states, if you compare us with the other states, we'd go from 28th, where we currently are with that data, to rank 20th. And if you look at total taxes, a percent of income, it's an increase of about 1.5%. Percent of income, from 10.1 to 11.6, that would move us from 26th to 9th. One of the questions I get asked is, well, what do we have historically that might be comparable? The closest answer in terms of recent memory and magnitude is Measure 5. Measure 5 reduced property taxes from 4.9% of income to 3.1% over the five-year phase-in period, so 1.8 differential. This is 1.5. And by the way, if you look at the rankings in 88-89, on a per capita basis, Oregon was 21st, 100% of income basis, we were 10th. So that gives you kind of a sense of kind of the magnitude of the overall changes. Now, of course, you're talking about a whole different tax change, but magnitude, rough magnitude, initial magnitude, similar in terms of the size of the economy. So this will have significant effects on the mix of our taxes, and I'll switch here to state taxes. And the thinking, we always think about the mix of state taxes in terms of your decision making, in terms of the stability of your state revenue stream. You can see the current mix, and I've shown you all the big red bar ad nauseum. Personal income tax is 69%, and that's accounted for by the blue part of the pie chart there under current law. So 69% net corporate income taxes are about 5%, and you can see the other categories. The IP 28 superimposing that on the 13-14 data, personal income tax goes from 69 to 55%. So still bigger than half, still the dominant tax, but not as dominant certainly as it is under current law. And then you can see the red corporate tax goes to, I think about 0.9% is what it is, goes from about 5% to 0.9% as that's squeezed in, the amount paid on net income, it gets much smaller. The big gray slice there is the gross receipt slice. That's the minimum, which you, is actually in the current law of pie. You just can't see it because it's so small. Mm-hmm. So, and then it goes to 22%, 22.6%. So a significant change in the mix of taxes for state taxes in the state as a result of this measure. And we'll look at the, some of the stability implications in a little bit on that. We, of course, spent a little bit of time on gross receipts taxes because we're shifting to Oregon sales or a gross receipts base. And these are the states that have the gross receipts tax. Delaware and Washington have the longest experience. And then you've had Ohio, we've talked about the CAT, and the Texas margin tax, which is a bit of a hybrid. It does, it takes gross receipts and subtract out cost of goods sold. So it's a more narrow base, and some like it for that reason. But that means you'd have to have higher rates to generate the same amount of revenue. Nevada is patterned somewhat after Washington. It has differential rates based on the estimated effective tax rates in these different sectors. Washington did a lot of work in the 80s estimating how much pyramiding there is within industries, how many transactions are. It was a gross receipts tax would tax at multiple stages. And so what they have are lower rates for those sectors that have a lot of transactions, like processing. Food processing is the one they estimate to have the most transactions. So they adjust for it with those rates. You can see, though, if you look at kind of the magnitude of these taxes, they're all around 5%. Nevada's will be a little bit less. By the way, Nevada's is subject to a referendum in November, so I mean, that's subject to voter approval, even though it's already operational. But Washington is the only one that's close to the magnitude we're looking at for IP 28 at 18% compared to 22 in our estimates. So let me say a few things about the economic estimates. We ran these through a simulation of our model. We used the corporate tax data by industry to come up with estimates for the effective tax rate by industry. It varies significantly. By far the highest rates are in retail trade and wholesale trade. The overall rate is 0.93%. I would emphasize that that overall rate is not something we input anywhere. It's what comes out of the sum of the industry effects. It does not imply that all corporations or all businesses are going to be paying that tax. It's only going to be those corporations that you saw in the under the data. So a relatively small number of initial taxpayers pay, but the overall average effective rate is 0.93%. And since this is a general equilibrium model, we plug in those effective rates at the industry level. And that produces the effects in the model. And as I say, if you look, for example, at the corporate sales, corporate sales that are affected by the measure, it's about 76%. And the retail trade sector is about 88%. But of course, you have sectors that have other entities that are not directly affected by the measure. So you're going to see some shifting within that industry. You're also dealing with a small number of large corporations who have pricing power and have market power. So that's where we see the highest uncertainty, is how some of those individual markets will shake out. There should be a competitive advantage for a small company that isn't affected by this relative to a big one who is. But then the question becomes how, the economist term homogeneous, how homogeneous are their products? How homogeneous is a small convenience store versus a great big grocery store? You know, are they exactly, they're not comparable exactly, but there could be some crossover where one sector is not paying the tax where the other is directly. So those are the kinds of shifts we would anticipate over time. But nonetheless, if you look at the corporate sector overall, you have the vast majority of sales are affected by the measure. And the distribution is among those sectors that tend to be consumer sectors, like utilities, retail trade, wholesale trade. One of the things that I think has caused confusion, and part of it is just us kind of ham-handedly trying to explain our simulation results, they're always put in the context of the forecast, the current law forecast. So they're designed to, they're not a prediction, they're a prediction of a deviation from the current law forecast. And we assume it takes about 5 years for a major tax change to filter through the economy. So what we've done here is look at this comparison, taking the 2022 projection from the state economists from February, comparing and plugging in the changes from our simulation and comparing the two. So, you know, as I've talked with the chair about this a good deal, if you look at what's going to happen over the next 5 years in terms of the economy, it's probably going to be driven by things way beyond decisions, tax policy, or individual policy decisions. It's probably going to be the national economy, international economy. So that's what's going to drive this first column of 2022 under current law, and that will be the dog that wags the tail. So if you look at kind of the differences in the last two columns, I put them in two ways. One is you can look at the raw numbers, and we kind of wanted to jam all of these into a table because of some comments we got from Senator Riley and some of our other stuff. If you look at the raw numbers, they look big. If you look at them proportionally, you get a different sense of the impact. So we wanted to put them together so you can make that decision in terms of the implications. But you can see that personal income is down by about $430 million. Some of that is clearly due to a smaller population. Employment estimates are 20,000 less than they would be under the current law forecast. But you can see the current law forecast calls for growth of 166,000 between now and 2022. So we're not saying that there's going to be layoffs but there's going to be some reduction in any given year. We're saying that the growth rate will be slower. So instead of 166,000 or 6.5% growth, we would see 145,000 or 5.7% growth. So it's a moderation of the projected growth rate. And that's the way all these models work, these macro general equilibrium models. They're put into a time context. So, you know, the economy is going to go on. This is might modify that the growth rate, but the economy will go on, and driven by these other bigger factors. A couple of interesting things is one is wages, and the other is prices. Wages go up largely because of a shift in employment mix, and you'll see that in a minute. We have less retail trade, wholesale trade employment, more government employment, and those we get less jobs but higher wages now on average. These are all based on current data. So then if you look at the prices, remember the increase from in taxes as a percent of income. In fact, we push them forward to 2017 is about 1.4%. So you're increasing taxes 1.4% of income. You're driving up prices about 0.9%. So about two-thirds of that increase gets embedded in the prices system in one way or another, predominantly in the wholesale and retail trade sectors. And some other sectors like utilities, for example. So that's how it will filter through the model. One of the things I should say about increases about consumption taxes, which is basically what the results are, they tend to have less effects on the real economy, less effects on employment and output than, say, an income tax or a property tax, that more directly affects the return to labor or the return to capital. Those have bigger effects on the real economy. That's why, and I know some of you that have worked with us over the years, why we can have a consumption tax and an equal reduction in income taxes and still get a net plus in the economy. Because the consumption tax has less of an effect, negative effect on the economy than the income tax has a positive effect by being reduced. So, and that's just the standard result of these regional models. Factors of production are more sensitive to those taxes that affect their rate of return. Consumption taxes don't directly affect them, only indirectly. So, again, you can see where we've divided this up. Private sector's down by about 38,000. Again, instead of 6.6% growth, you get 4.9. And, of course, you've got a shift taking place from the private sector to the public sector. Public sector increases by about 17,000 in our projections. We assume that spending is the same, stays the same in proportional terms. We cover demand side effects. The public sector is assumed to spend all those dollars that come in. So there's a balanced budget. So the way we describe it is we're not changing the mix of spending. And, of course, that would be up to you. That would be the decision of the legislature, how it's spent, ultimately. And that could affect what the ultimate impacts are, certainly. But we assume they stay the same just because we're not going to get into ways and means kind of issues and look at individual types of expenditures. So the demand side effects indicate you get a public sector gain, but a private sector loss in employment that's greater. And if you look at the sectors that are hit, you can see that over half comes from retail trade, wholesale trade, health services. There's an other service category in there. And then in the real sector, manufacturing and natural resources, remember they're the tangible personal property exporters, producers. So they've still got the sales factor working in their favor. If they're exporters, they're not as affected. Who's more affected are those domestic sectors that have higher organ sales proportionally. And that shows up in these numbers. So the next table looks at when we looked at the business tax and we said, okay, how does it shift business taxes and household taxes? It obviously increases the share initially paid by business, but that's only one step of the incidence process. The incidence process looks at the after-tax real income. A real income is income adjusted for changes in prices by income group. We have 9 household income groups in our OTIM model, And you can see we take the average reduction in real after-tax income. So the price effect is predominantly what's working here. And you can see that it increases with income. So that higher income people, the greater than 206,000 folks, end up with the biggest impact in terms of their real purchasing power after tax, but they end up with the smallest percentage change of their income. So what that's suggesting is that the marginal effect of the tax, as a consumption tax typically is regressive. Mm-hmm. It makes an ad, it reduces the progressivity of the current system. So let's look at the current system. We've spent a lot of time working on updating our baseline estimate. That's the blue line. So you get an increase here, but the shift up is slightly more on the lower end and less on the higher end. So you get that somewhat of a flattening at the high end. But I would say, subjective, I guess, but I would say that the system, incidence of the system, the progressiveness stays relatively the same. It's roughly a proportional system. With taxpayers paying about the same percentage of their income, you have a regressive tail that's caused by the residential property tax, and you have a progressive tail at the other end, largely caused by the changes enacted by the legislature in recent years, the 9.9% rate, phase out of federal tax subtraction, elimination of the personal exemption credit. Those things all have caused that tilt up a bit. So that structure remains in place. So it's a little less progressive at the higher end, but nonetheless, compared to most states that have a retail sales tax, you typically get a regressive distribution almost across the board. And Oregon's current system is one of the few that is close to being proportional, and that would roughly stay the same. Now, when we got into looking at the corporate tax liability, we had a couple things to look at. We wanted to estimate some baseline where it would be with no changes, and we went through and did that. One of the first things we had to do, we had to go from 2012 or 2013, our last data, and blow it up to 17. And one of the reasons, as you'll see, we've gotten higher estimates than we've told you before is because we saw higher growth in 13, and we're seeing higher growth nationally in those in sales by large corporations. The national economy is becoming more concentrated. So we factored that into our jumping off point in 17, and that pushed up those estimates. And you can see the growth rate we built in. We used some projections on national sales and tweaked those a bit for both the concentration and for the fact that you do have a general shift out of C-Corp status. And that's one of the factors that has occurred. We moved to S-corporations and other types of entities. But the orange line is the one that we adjusted based on the economic simulations. And the other thing we did, which actually was bigger in magnitude, was an adjustment for what we thought would be a estimate of what tax planning changes would be. And we think that effect will soften the growth in the future. Do we have a lot of confidence in the precision of that estimate? No. But we think if we left it out, we thought we'd have an upward bias in the estimates. So we thought it was important to include. And I'll talk about some of those in a minute, some of those tax planning strategies. Here's the revenue impact estimates. As I said, you've got some revenue in 15-17 because it becomes effective January 1 of 17. We took about 20% of the liability and estimated to be collected in the last 6 months of the biennium. And you can see then we're about $6.1 billion. Part of that 17-19 number is blown up because we've pushed some of the startup liquidity into that collection period. And then we get back to more normal lag in the collection process, and that's why it goes to about $6 billion. So we do have underlying, you look at the liability, there is underlying growth of about 2.5% in the liability. We think that probably would go up, that growth rate, once you've shaken out these tax planning adjustments. Because we look at the B&O taxes, grows about 4% a year. Okay, so there's your revenue impact estimate that we would have. As I say, it's a little bit higher than what we had before. we have used in the past what we call the stability meter, which is just a pure mix effect on stability and growth. So we look at all this, all state tax data, and we look at, okay, what if everything else is the same except for the mix of taxes you have? So Washington's mix produces, because it's dominated by consumption taxes, produces slow growth, 4.4% versus Oregon's 5.3, but very stable, 3.9% standard deviation. Now, current law for Oregon, we have high growth, but we have high instability, which, of course, you live with the consequences of that. But what this would do is slow the growth down, because your personal income taxes are a smaller percentage of it. But the bigger effect would be basically eliminating the net, well, not eliminating, but sharply reducing revenue from the net corporate income tax, which is very volatile, has the highest standard deviation in any of the individual taxes, and going to a gross receipts base, which is a lot more stable. The B&O tax has historically been slightly more unstable than the retail sales tax in Washington, but a lot, but more stable than the personal income tax and a lot more stable than the corporate income tax. So that's why you get that reduction in standard deviation. I think, as I told the Senate committee, I do think that California number is probably too low because it's based on a national average for the income tax, and they have a very distributed toward the high end and very volatile income components in the California base. The point is you would see some stability gains resulting from the change in the mix. Okay, the uncertainty. Well, we think there's a number of categories that the uncertainty would occur, but there's two big ones. One is just the magnitude of the revenue impact. And so, you know, most of our modeling is based on marginal changes within the historical sample period. You're going outside this. This is a big change by historical standards for a state. 25% change in state taxes, 15% state and local overall. So those are significant changes in the system. We don't have a lot of historical experience. I mentioned Measure 5, which it can be instructive. You ask people about, well, what were the effects of Measure 5? Some would say they helped in the economic growth of the 90s. Other would say they had nothing to do with it, and they had negative effects on the spending side. So you get those same kinds of responses. But nonetheless, it's rough magnitude. Concentration of direct revenue impact concerns us for the estimates. One thing, it does lead to the possibility of shifts within industries because you have big players that are paying the tax and the others are not. The question, again, is how close to substitutes they are. We think in some cases there'll be some shifting, other cases probably very little. But 85% is paid by that top 274 corporations, over half by just 50 corporations. So the decisions they make in terms of pricing decisions, if they make any adjustments in location, that's going to be where the big effects are going to occur from those corporations. And as any economist will tell you, you know, the models for oligopolistic markets where you have a few big players are not deterministic. You don't have a theoretical solution. It depends on the behavior of the individual players in that market. So when you're dealing with big corporations, that's more likely the case. So if we kind of look at some upside and downside risks, the risk to the public sector, as I said, we capture the spending side of the public sector. So the public sector is buying stuff from the factor markets. They're paying for their labor. They're making purchases from the other sectors of the economy. But we're not assuming that they have any effect on the productive capacity of the economy, that these investments don't increase the productivity of labor or capital more than they would be otherwise. And you could argue that they would over time if you did the right programs and invest them efficiently. Education, for example, is a classic case. If you increase the productivity of your labor force, you will have stronger growth. That's just arithmetic. But how long does that take? What specific program would do that? What would be the quantitative impact? Those things are all kind of steps beyond our analysis. So it's highly dependent on those specific programs and how it's spent. But it's a possibility for an upside risk, certainly. The same could be argued in terms of infrastructure expenditures like transportation, for example. or even things that improve public safety that increase the certainty of property investments. So all of those things can filter in and change the capacity of the economy over time. So those are what we call the supply side effects. We leave those out primarily because they're so program specific. We don't have good specific estimates, and the timing is much different. They're much likely to be longer term. You invest in early childhood education, it's not going to affect your economy in 5 years. It might in 20 years. So downside risks, or upside risks, continuing tax exporting is a major one. And one of the questions we've had a lot is around federal tax deductibility. We built in federal tax deductibility, and that's a results in direct exporting to the federal government in 2017 dollars of about $960 million. So, and that's about 16%, or about, excuse me, about 25% of the overall initial impact. That's through the deductibility of state and local tax. Now, pricing decisions affect that ultimately, how much that is in the economy, but that's true of any income tax changes, whether corporate or personal, state and local taxes can be deducted. OTEM has a effective tax, federal tax rate for each sector, so we calculated for each sector what that exporting would be, and that's about 25% overall as the effective tax rate, so of course it's 25% of that amount. So that's built in, but did we underestimate it? Certainly, possibly we did. There's been discussion around uniform pricing strategies, internet sales, remote sales, national pricing policies. Those things are certainly possible. They don't really pan out in terms of revenue max or profit maximizing models. Usually economists don't assume those types of strategies are used unless they maximize profits. But we can think of examples of that. To the extent that occurs, you could have potentially more exporting, and that's a upside risk. The more you can shift, it's, you know, the classic tax that's exported is the Alaska severance tax. I mean, it doesn't have as big a negative effect on Alaska because we pay it in Oregon and other states that consume oil and gas. So anything that's out-of-state residents in these models means that you don't have as big of a direct impact. If you look at the downside risks, I think the major one is we've modeled this as an excise tax or consumption tax. Factor taxes have bigger impacts on real output and employment. By factor taxes, I mean a tax on net corporate income or a tax on personal income or a tax on property, reproducible capital. Okay. So any of those factors, taxes, we get bigger impacts out of the model. And that makes sense because you're affecting the rate of return on that factor production. You're in an open system, you're going to have less investment in capital and fewer workers here if you reduce the return to those components. So a consumption tax has a softer effect on the overall economy because it doesn't directly affect those rates of return. To the extent they do, we would be underestimating the effects. And then the one I mentioned, the corporate tax planning, is the toughest because you know, you can think of things. We could sit in a room and think of some different things, and there's probably other stuff that corporate tax planners will be thinking of that are way beyond what we're thinking. So just some of the examples, shifting to S-corporate status. We may see some of that. We mentioned they're surprising to me anyway, the number of S-corporations that are over 25 million. But nonetheless, if you're thinking about a big corporation, you're not going to shift to an S corporation because you got to have less than 100 shareholders. So it's not feasible for a lot of the big players. But for those at the margin, it could be. The vertical integration is always cited as an incentive for any gross receipts or transactional tax type system. Vertical integration, anything reduces the transactions, reduces the tax. Thinking of ways to spin off subsidiaries, Oregon currently has a, you have to file a combined return for everybody in your filing group, so you can't have a subsidiary and then not have it in your corporate tax group. But if you spin it off as a separate entity, then you could technically get below that $25 million, and I suspect we'll see some of that being looked at. The cost of performance we mentioned, you can certainly, you could imagine through mergers would be probably the easiest thing to do, to think in terms of where your plurality of your service is produced. And I've talked to corporations that are subject to the cost of performance, telling me that, well, we're paying a lot of taxes, and then we were bought by a bigger out-of-state company that now our plurality of our service is in Washington. We don't pay anything. So those kinds of mergers become more incentive to do that. And then finally, the benefit company one. Hard to say that impact, but we've talked to some accountants, and they think that we may see some of that at the margin, too, where the smaller, particularly more Oregon-specific companies will be looking at that status. So we've tried to build that in, estimating that it's not going to have a huge effect on revenue, but we think it'll affect growth over time in those first few years as companies look for those kind of rational responses. Again, none of these are illegal. They're just the types of planning responses we typically see. Okay, key findings. Just to go through these in small print. The first is the $548 million, 15-17 impact, $6.1 billion. I think we were up around 5.3, so we increased that quite a bit because of that growth we've seen in that Oregon sales category. $600 per capita increase. And 1.5% increase overall in the economy. That 1.5% increase leads to the 0.9% increase in prices. So you can think of that as about 2/3 of that fitting into prices. Not only price at the final level, but intermediate level too. And that's where we get the sense it affects the domestic consumer sectors, utilities, retail trade, wholesale trade. Largest sector experienced the largest increases. We would expect those to act as a consumption tax in the economy. Emphasize that we do estimate some slower growth. We don't think that this is going to result in actual declines from where we are now, but rather will dampen growth. And if you look at this in terms of the forecasted levels for 2022, the simulation results reduce those by all less than 1%. So we're not looking at a major change, but rather a modification of the growth projected, dampening of the growth projected in the future. And this is consistent with our general finding on state taxes, is that they matter, but they're not the dominant factor in growth in an economy, and not the dominant factor in location decisions. The impact on prices means that the marginal tax effect, if we look at it in isolation as we did in that table, will be regressive. But if we superimpose that on the overall system, it still remains largely proportional, although slightly less so, but it would overall be proportional, particularly relative to other states. The increase in the gross receipts tax base will add to stability. It's a question of how much, but it clearly would add to stability based on everything we know about the behavior of the different tax sources over the course of the business cycle. Slower growth over time, less elasticity, generally translates into more stability. So that's the trade-off that you make. Because of the impact, it's isolated, it's concentrated impact and the relative size, we do think there's considerable uncertainty in these estimates, and we try to be truth in advertising, and I don't think anybody could argue there's not a lot of uncertainty for these kinds of changes. So I want to make sure you're aware of that. We've tried to build in everything we can that makes sense into these simulations to give you a good objective estimate, but they're definitely uncertainties. Finally, one of the things we have always emphasized about change, what you're really talking about is a change in the size of the public sector. And this is whether number of states have gone to big reductions. This one would go to an increase in the relative size. There isn't an optimal size of the public sector. The bigger is worse or smaller is better. It overall depends on this combined effect of the revenue mechanism, and I think that's obviously our focus. We're revenue guys, so we focused on that and what we know about the different types of taxes and how they affect the economy and distribution of the tax burden. But ultimately, it has to interact with what it's used to fund or the spending side. And if that can have a significant, and you can just think about your budget now. And if you spend it all in one or two categories, it'd have a lot different impact than spending in other categories, both in terms of the distribution and in terms of the overall long-term effects on economic growth. So I think you always have to keep that in mind. When you look at these kind of proposals, you have to weigh both the revenue side and the expenditure side to get the full impact on the economy. So with that, I will stop.
And open for questions.
Wow.
Thank you. I have to say, this is the second time I've sat through this presentation. Representative Smith Warner and I sat through it this morning as well. I've learned things now that I didn't actually hear this morning because it's very packed. I appreciate the enormous amount of work that you and your staff have done and some other people you mentioned have done to prepare the report. And also, you're very careful statement about the limitations of it, especially the very last one, that the question, where the money is spent makes a huge difference on what the long-term economic impacts are.
Yes.
With that, I'm sure we have some questions, and I saw Representative Davis' hand first, so you get to ask the first one.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Paul, very much. I'm going to ask the question that the room is just waiting to hear the answer to. Is this good or is this bad?
Is this where I get to do my one hand and the other hand?
No, I'll ask a more specific question as opposed to leaving that. Thank you, Chair. My question is of the in full freight at $6.1 billion taxes generated, I think many people are interested to hear what portion would be borne by either a reduction in corporate profits versus passed on to consumers in Oregon. So how much is an average family in Oregon going to see an increase in, is it either its utility prices, healthcare prices, other service goods and services, versus it being absorbed into the economics of these entities?
Well, you can look at the overall effect on the price level. Which is here, you can see that prices are up about 0.89%. Now, this is broader than consumer prices because this includes intermediate sectors as well. And so 0.89%, I mean, that doesn't sound like a huge amount, but it's a $200 billion economy. So 1% of that is $2 billion. So you can think of that as a real rough number in terms of mm-hmm. the impact of prices. On the other hand, the measure itself, as we said, is about 1.4%. So if you divide those two, you get a rough estimate of what's resulted in higher prices. About 65% of that initial impact results in higher prices. Both, you know, some things we can have, you know, a doubling up in sectors like retail trade because they get passed through from at the gross receipts level from the wholesalers. So, and it's very unevenly distributed, but if you look at the kind of growth effect there, it's about two-thirds of that tax ends up in the form of higher prices. About a third of it is either exported or some marginal real effects that we showed in the economy in terms of employment and output. So, and the largest difference between those is the deductibility of federal taxes, is the amount mm-hmm. that's exported to the federal government. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a rough sense. The household numbers we have here, these are not, you know, increases in the tax bill that people have. These are the indirect effects that these would be seen as average after-tax real income. So they build in the price effect, so the purchasing power effect. And you can see that for the typical household, we're looking at anywhere from about 0.9% down to about 0.4% for the higher income households. The total, I think, is about 0.6% is the impact on real take-home, real inflation-adjusted income after wage and price changes. So that kind of gives you a sense of the magnitude and the distribution.
One follow-up, Mr.
Yes, Chair. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Paul. Going back to slide 8 on the impact, I'm most fascinated, I think, with, for example, utilities and healthcare, which go from a baseline of, you might say, essentially zero. I mean, those numbers are pretty darn close to being tax at zero, up to $100 million each. Why the impact so much on those two industries?
Well, in simple terms, they have, under current law, they have very limited net income. So they're not paying much on that base, but they have a lot of sales. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think in common language, the way we've heard this, and certainly heard it with the Measure 67, was the effect on the low margin, high volume. I mean, that's just a classic example of it. Now, the utility side, because they're regulated, they tend to have relatively low net income, but they do have some high levels of sales. Of course, the other thing here, not only do you have to have a high level of sales, but it has to be concentrated in those affected corporations that have $25 million or more. So you have to have big players in it. Mm. In the healthcare, just looking at some individual data that was provided to us, I mean, it's primarily the pharmaceutical that have a distribution center here and they're selling within the state. So, and they're big enough so that they get over the thresholds. Mm-hmm. So, but that's where you see that, you know, if you look at some of these sectors, now retail, for example, you know, you think of a lot of smaller retailers, but if you look at just the C-Corp side, 88% of retail sales are affected by the measure. So, it's, you know, it, because you've got some of the big retailers that are accounting for a large percentage of it, and you can think of who they are. I'm not going to mention them because I'll get in trouble. So, but you can think of who they are, and that's, you know, those are tend to be national, international corporations. And, of course, their pricing decisions, as I say, you know, they're not always mechanical. They have options. They have bigger interests, certainly, than Oregon, global and regional sales and marketing concerns. So, you know, they're definitely a wild card in how their strategies will play out in terms of what those pricing decisions are.
Thank you very much. Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again. I would agree with Chair Barnhart that it gets more interesting every time you hear it. So I'll be coming back to the office later for you to tell it to me again. No, I'm just kidding. So I have kind of a combined question. It's partially about the overall, like, kind of margin of error question of kind of how you would assess your margin of error in this overall. And then more specifically, maybe this is part of it, is how you came up with the numbers to feed into the OTIM model, which is you took the 2013s, figured out what it would have been based on returns, and then projected that out through each sector, and then spread it out equally, even though specifically, not everyone in each of those sectors would have had the same impacts, because that was just a snapshot of 1 year's returns that you had. So I guess it's a combination question of the margin overall and kind of what were the other big significant variables in, you know, setting it up so that you could run it through the OTIM model.
Okay. Well, one thing I will say, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, is that in my experience, here, but also doing the current law revenue forecast, one of the biggest margin sources of error was not knowing exactly where you were when you made the forecast. And you would find out that, gee, we were way down from where I thought we were, and that would be a portion of the error. So that shifting from 13 to 17 is definitely a source of uncertainty. That, you know, we used to say you've got to get the base right. We think we do. I mean, we've made a pretty good estimate on it, but that can swing those overall numbers, so that's certainly an important factor. But the 13 corporate tax returns do give us the best structural guide, certainly by industry for these numbers, and by a size. So we don't think we're going to get anything more accurate than that. We try to adjust them for what we know about the overall economy between 13 and 17. I think we've, you know, that's the best way to do those estimates. The key in terms of the modeling for the OTIM model is these taxes by industry, and that's where we generate an effective tax rate by industry, which is these taxes based on gross receipts, the new minimum tax, as a percentage of what we estimate in the OTIM model to be total industry sales, not just the companies that are affected, and not just C corporations, but all sales in that sector. So, and that varies a lot. We have some sectors, retail, wholesale, trade, are way above 1 as a percent. And we have other sectors that, because they're predominantly smaller producers, they're well less than 1%. The average overall is 0.93%. But that varies widely by industry. So you do have the possibility of shifting within the industry. And a lot of factors can come into play on that. I mean, I've had some questions on this since the morning from reporters. And to me, I think the key distinction is this is a general equilibrium model. We're trying to build in industry level. We're not going to the micro individual firm foundation level to look at how, you know, competitive strategies might affect market share. And that's just not general equilibrium models don't do that. They're aimed at the estimating the overall aggregate numbers. But I think some of that work would be interesting to do and something certainly to think about. You could think about some specific sectors and what strategies would do, and it's more really a micro simulation type analysis. So it's a different analysis than what we've done here. I think it would give us some insight if we had some good work done in that area, particularly for some of these sectors that we're saying are going to be the most affected by what the data is telling us. So yeah, there's a lot of things I think to explore further at that specific industry level, and not to mention just the strategies of some of these bigger corporations and can we look at maybe scenarios on different pricing strategies.
Thank you.
Representative Knowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we go to the slide previous to this one? So if I'm understanding it correctly, 106 filers are going to pay 60% of the generated tax revenue under this under this model, right?
They're going to pay 60% of the new total.
Okay, so I'm following. So I guess what I guess my line of thinking, and I'm asking you to correct me if I'm wrong on this, is don't you think that 106, those are big retail entities, right? Like, I guess I'm wondering, is Amazon really going to try to figure out how to charge something slightly less for a comic book that I buy in Oregon? You know, when they're marketing on such a large scale, like, are they really going to care about, you know, which is a large tax increase for us, but, I mean, they have a national price-setting strategy. I mean, like, I had a small retailer, not in my district, but right next to it, explained to me that the T-shirts he sells from Calvin Klein, he is told what the price is going to be. He doesn't get to decide, you know, what that they make that decision. And I guess I just think most of that 106, you know, are they really going to take our gross receipts tax and figure out how to distribute it across the entire United States or maybe the globe? Because, you know, they're big retailers. You know, this is just a cost of doing business for them.
Representative Knowles, yeah, you know, those are definitely some things to think about. As you know, as I said, and you know, we look at kind of markets that are dominated by big players. They're not deterministic because, you know, those behavioral factors come into play, and so that's where we, you know, our emphasis in the report is in terms of the risks that creates, both upside and downside. But I do think, though, that the other side of the coin on the concentrated impact is that the dollars get pretty big. You know, that group's paying $1.7 billion, and while Oregon is a small player in the world economy, you know, that's a significant increase of what, you know, they're paying to Oregon now. So I think you will see some reaction, and I think you'll see reactions across the spectrum. You'll see some, as you suggest, where, you know, this is an issue where we don't think it's worth changing our pricing strategy that's worked for us, or it may be that we know that when we get more Oregon sales, we pay this amount more, and then therefore we'll make an adjustment. So I think we'll see across the spectrum.
Yes,
it's more of a comment,
yes.
Mr. Chair. I
just
say that I, for one, and I mean, we have such needs in this state. My two children have spent, you know, two decades in Portland public schools where they've seen nothing but cuts and shorter school years. I mean, and I for one am very excited about the possibility that we might finally do something to change the course the state got on when we passed Measure 5 in 1990. Even if it's going to create a little turbulence as we get there.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt, please.
Yes. Back to, I think it's graph 6 or 8 with the list of industries. There you go. So in all of those industries, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is only one that is allowed to pass on to consumers prudently incurred costs as a direct charge, and that would be the utilities. And so could we infer from that that everyone who pays an electric bill would probably, under the law that we presently have, see an increase of about 3.6% in their energy or utility bill?
Representative Whitson, Mr. Chair, you know, I think you're going to clearly see upward pressure on those regulated prices. Remember that not all the utility industry falls under this, and not all are regulated. So
the consumer-owned.
So it's there's regional differences and those kinds of things. But certainly, I think it's safe to say it's more likely that that number will translate into a regulated price adjustment. Of course, ultimately, it depends on PUC and how they respond to it. But in typical fashion in the past, they've allowed those standardized costs to be built in. So we would expect that to be one of the direct effects, yes.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for all this work. This is extraordinarily important for our state. And a couple of questions, Mr. Chair.
Please.
The first, I would like you to go back to a slide. I think it's 14. If I have this one right, employment impacts, and I note that the slide earlier nets out the employment loss, but it appears that the private sector loses 38,000 jobs. Am I reading that right?
Where do you see that? Yes, the net effect there is the combination of those two, and you see that there, 20,000 is the net of the two. That's the net of the minus 38 and the plus 18.
Right, but I'm asking about the private sector as opposed to adding public jobs.
Yeah, the private sector is, there's a shift that takes place from the private sector to the public sector as a result of the policy.
And the loss in the private sector is?
The loss is 38,000 is the reduction from the current projection for 2022. So instead of increasing by 148,000, we would estimate 110,000, or 4.9 instead of 6.6% growth over that 5-year period. So, in other words, dampened or lesser growth as a result of this.
Another question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
And on the next slide is slide number 15, and it shows that income groups at less than 21,000 a year change baseline of $372, 21,000, 34,000 to $500. This is the result, the estimated result from this particular 2.5% sales tax. We just passed a minimum wage increase that's horribly regressive. This chart does not capture the cumulative impact of that particular new law, and this law does it. This chart is only limited to the possibility of this passing.
Mr. Vice Chair, yes, this is this is an incremental analysis. It's not built in what those cumulative effects might be. Now, eventually, those get built into the current law forecast. The wage numbers and the employment numbers will get built into the current law forecast from the minimum wage change. But this does not combine those effects. No.
All right. Thank you. Another.
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this goes take us back to page 4, if we could. And I liked your reference to the interesting impact that the situation reflected on the right hand side of that shows. And this is a possibility of losing a lot of our businesses. The one I always hear about is software, and this is the service issue that we've talked about a lot during our short session. And I believe there was a bill brought to try to head this off. It didn't pass. And thus, if this law were to pass, we would find those who have a service-oriented business looking for an exit strategy pretty rapidly from this state. Am I right there? And if so, can you explain to me how I'm right?
Faith.
Yes, Mr.
I know I'm right.
You're right.
Thank you.
No, we've talked about the cost performance apportionment method since going back to 2011, I think is the most recent, the earliest one we found a bill looking at that. So it has been an issue that's been discussed. And it would certainly have different implications by increasing the size of the minimum tax. It really came to our attention when Measure 67 passed. And we started hearing from some businesses that were affecting the Portland area, for example, or in Southern Oregon that had interstate sales. And then California went to a market-based approach for their services. So then you've run the risk, and we heard this in testimony, that you can be a service company where all of your, by Oregon's methods, all your income is apportioned to Oregon, yet your sales percentage is apportioned to California. And that's always been one of the risks with different apportionment formulas. You can have, you know, either a very low percentage or you can have over 100%, depending on the apportionment method used by the different states. So, yes, that's a concern. We think under current law, this would magnify it. I'm not sure it's safe to say that they would move from Oregon, because one of the strategies I just mentioned would be if you're purchased by a corporation that has significant activity in California or Washington, and therefore shifts where the plurality of your service is performed, then that could get you out of the, out from under this tax as
maybe
well. So I think it will be something we'll see. Service companies that export or focused on exporting, it's going to be a big issue for them, but they've got tax planning strategies as well as real economic alternatives too. So I suspect, and I've talked with both revenue chairs about this, that if this were to pass, you'd have a lot of your agenda would be pretty full for the 17th session in terms of revenue policy.
Thank you.
There'd be a lot of issues.
And I would point out that was my bill, and I would expect, I'd be kind of amazed if I didn't think of it again.
It would be a surprise.
I have a couple of questions as well. On page 9, I didn't realize it was that funny, but that's fine. On page 9, is it 9? Yes. Maybe I've got it wrong. It may be a different page. You spent some time talking about how you changed the denominator from gross state product to personal income.
Okay.
On the issue of estimating corporate taxes. That makes sense, I think, if the tax is paid entirely in state. Mm-hmm. But this tax, as you describe it, is paid at least in part by somebody else outside of Oregon. Could you describe how that affects these numbers that you've got here, that 5.6% number as compared to about 4%? Number that you're looking at on page 9. It's something that I've been looking at this and thinking about. It doesn't seem to me as though with these comparisons between states you have looked at the fact that a certain percentage of all taxes are paid by people from other places. The basketball player who comes in and plays in Portland is going to pay an Oregon income tax even though he lives somewhere else. And obviously for sales tax states, when an Oregonian visits Washington or California, we're going to pay a sales tax, which those states collect, and a variety of other taxes as well. Have you looked at the effect of this change on the portion of the taxes actually paid by Oregonians versus paid by other people in some form or another?
Mr. Chair, I think we have some that implicitly embedded in the OTIM analysis, because that's a big part of the exporting. I mentioned the idea that roughly 30% or over 30% isn't translated into prices. So I think we're looking at a number around 30% that would be exported in one form or another, with the deductibility being the major one. But one thing we could certainly do, the Tax Foundation produces an annual estimate of the amount of tax exports and tax imports by state, and it's based on specific taxes. So we could look at some of the Tax Foundation methodology and see how imposing something like this might affect our so-called terms of trade with taxes. We have traditionally been an importer, so which means that we are importing taxes from other states more than we're exporting, so we've been a net importer, and we always emphasize when we talk about state in the OTIM model, we're talking about state and local taxes for Oregon. you know, individuals can are paying federal taxes, and they could be paying indirectly taxes from other states. So the Tax Foundation indicates that we are now on net importing taxes. So we could look at their methodology and see, and maybe dig into that a little further. But I think right now what we're looking at is roughly 30%, which is exported through different methods in the model.
So with IP 28, we would be less of a net tax importer?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
But I'm not, I don't look at the methodology.
You'll figure that out.
Because is one they do every year. So we've got a time period so we can look at how they model different changes. So we'll take a look at it. And we've looked at it in the past. So it's interesting. The easy ones are the severance tax.
Okay.
And that's what makes the big difference. Wyoming, Alaska, you know, North Dakota, they're exporting a lot of their taxes. So Nevada's another one through the gross gaming receipts tax. So, and they have estimates for those various kinds of taxes. And I'll see what they use for some of the other business-related taxes that might be somewhat similar to this.
Right. We buy petroleum products that are made entirely in other places, and North Dakota and Alaska and other places have already added a tax onto that, which we end up paying.
Yes.
That's part of what you're saying, I think.
Right, and we have inelastic demand for those products. So
right.
Built into the price.
Right. I've noted as in this report that let me ask it this way, and you tell me if you agree or to the extent to which you disagree. It looks as though with these projections that you're making about net effects, you're basing it on the assumption that the movements in the economy are going to be those as predicted in the forecast.
Mr. Chair, we have faith in the state economists.
Right. And, of course, we've discussed what that means in the past, that all of us have equally high faith in the state economist, I think. But unforeseen changes in the economy, up or down, other things that might affect Oregon, are not included here. And I think you said early on that those impacts are likely to be much greater than the impact of this measure.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I think I said it in this afternoon session, but I think the basic perspective is, and what we base our analysis is, that state tax policy matters in the short run. But certainly in the long run it matters, and especially as we talked about with expenditures and how that may affect overall expenditure. So it is a factor determining growth over time or rates of growth, but it is clearly not the dominant factor, particularly in the short run. Other factors are almost guaranteed to be more important, and that's why we point out the percentage deviation of these major variables like employment and income is less than 1% from the forecast. So we would certainly, if we go into recession, all those numbers go down. So we would be in we don't have a cyclical downturn built into the current law forecast. It's just a trend forecast. I think these are pretty reasonable in terms of trend estimates, but in terms of predicting what's going to happen in the short term, it's really going to be the national economy, international economy, the kinds of factors, the value of the dollar, the kinds of things that influence Oregon's economy more traditionally. But of course, the one thing we do look at here is that in that cyclical forecast is that stability index, and that's why we wanted to include that, because the mix of taxes does affect how your revenue responds over the course of the business cycle. And even though you may get some longer-term effects, you may end up with more stability over the shorter term.
We're all aware of how when the national economy gets a chill, Oregon has a much bigger decline.
Yes.
That effect would be smaller.
That effect would be smaller. Oregon, I mean, there's two major factors that cause us to have greater cyclical instability. One is our economy. It's the structure of our economy, the emphasis on durable goods manufacturing. This doesn't change that. It doesn't have a disproportionate negative effect on it, because there tend to be exporters. But on the other hand, it does affect that mix part and makes it more stable.
Great. Thank you. I was going to ask a question on uniform pricing, but I think we've hit that one pretty well. I know that when I buy a gadget like this, the iPhone, I think Apple charges the same price everywhere. Now they add the sales tax that other states, not here, of course, because we don't have it. But it's hard for me to imagine that Apple would raise the price here 2.5%, as compared with other places. That seems really unlikely, doesn't it?
It's hard to say, Mr. Chair. These are higher marginal gross receipts taxes than we see in other states. The Washington rate gets up to 1.5% on services, which are primarily domestic oriented. But we see lower rates in other gross receipts taxes. So we don't really have any good empirical evidence of how that would happen. Okay. But I think your point is correct, that we're going to see different responses from different corporations and what their pricing strategy is. And that's certainly a risk, either upside and downside for the forecast.
And that's what you meant when you said in an
oligopolistic
market, there is no theory.
No, not that there's no theory. It's not deterministic. We don't have a precise solution.
Now I know what those.
We have lots of theories.
Now I know what those words mean. Thank you. That's helpful. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was actually linked to your first question, and it had to do with the transparency that we're also interested in, knowing exactly who's paying how much for whatever it is we're buying with the $6 billion. I had a discussion earlier in the day about the challenge of trying to figure out how we would tell people what they're paying at the grocery store for the six-pack of beer they just bought as a result of this particular law. Can you share with us the difficulty we would have in trying to treat this as though it were a sales tax? I went through it this morning trying to go through three different ownerships as that beer made its way to the retail counter. Mm-hmm. And I was not clear on how we would show Joe Sixpack how he was going to or she was going to pay Joette Sixpack more for this beer. How can we do that, and is it possible for us to do it correctly and realistically?
Mr. Vice Chair, we use the term consumption tax, and I think it does because of the base being Oregon sales. And you could even argue that now our corporate income tax is a form of a consumption tax because of the sales factor. We always break out the specific types of consumption tax. One's traditional retail sales tax, and there where you do clearly have the markup occur at the counter. You have a more service-oriented or more expanded-based retail sales tax. But then with a value-added tax and a gross receipts tax, you're paying at the business level. And so, it gets into incidence and shifting that occurs through a gross receipts tax. You mentioned it's a transactions tax, so you do have the possibility of this pyramiding occurring. Value-added tax, you don't. I think you can show examples of that, and there are a lot of examples. Tax Foundation's done a lot of work on that. But one of the criticisms is that, it isn't transparent because it isn't something that you see at the, at the retail counter. So I think probably the best thing to do is look at these individual sectors and calculate how that might translate into prices in those different sectors. But I think it's going to vary by, obviously it's going to vary by the number of sellers that are directly affected. How many C-Corps are in that, how many over the threshold. And as I say, that's going to vary widely by sector. So this is a more complicated thing to explain because of that. You'll see some of that pricing going forward, and you'll see some of it leak out, as we've talked to Chair Barnhart about. So it's not a direct estimate that you could make without some underlying assumptions.
Yeah, please.
Right, because I understand the difficulty in figuring out how much each person is paying for this tax. What have other states had any success in being able to tell a consumer? I know 21% of this is going to be from retail trade, so people shopping at a grocery store are going to be paying it. Do other states have a way of calling out that which those people are paying?
I'm not aware of that, Mr. Vice Chair. We've kind of had an ebb and flow history of gross receipts taxes. They came in the 30s and were used particularly in the southern states, and they kind of went away. And then the only ones that stayed in place were Delaware and Washington. And Washington, as I say, did go through and make a pretty in-depth study of effective tax rates by sector. And so they estimated, you know, how much would be built into the price for a food processing sector versus data processing. Data processing was their lowest effective tax rate. So you can do those kinds of things, but being able to translate that into, you know, to consumers on a day-to-day basis would be a challenge.
Yeah. Yes,
and that's one of the criticisms that it isn't as direct as some other taxes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, in your report, you mentioned, I think, that manufacturers that would be creating products that they sell outside of the state of Oregon wouldn't be directly impacted by IP 28. But by virtue of being in the state of Oregon, if their utility rates are increased, that they're paying for their products and their other cost basis, then the cost of their product would go up, which might have an impact on their ability to have those sales in other states or other nationalities. Is that correct?
Representative Johnson, yes, I look at that direct citation, but I hope I said directly affected is what I tried to put in there.
Correct.
And that's that initial incidence mm-hmm. idea. But yes, you're correct. I mean, if your input supplier is passing on that marginal effect, it will definitely impact your costs. But it doesn't change kind of the basic dynamics around the, you know, the sales factor in the export-oriented industry. That was the point in terms of the direct effect.
Okay. Follow up.
Mm-hmm.
In your report about job losses, we've got 38,000 private sector jobs. Most of the large portion of those in retail, trade, a lot of others in wholesale. What impact to the state's economy do you factor into your report the loss of income from those jobs? Because what you're talking about here primarily in terms of the $6 billion is money that's coming out of somebody's pocket going into the state coffers, but what impact are the loss of those actual jobs creating to Oregon's economy?
Representative Johnson, that's the strength of the general equilibrium model. I mean, it ties all sectors together. So if we reduce employment in one sector, it filters through the whole economy. And so we're trying to get at these aggregate estimates. So it not only does it affect wage and salary income, if you view it in isolation, but it would also affect tax revenue coming into mm-hmm. the state. So those factors are built into, and that's what you saw in our dynamic effects, where we had, part of this is due to the difference between the orange line and the blue line. Part of that's due to those dynamic feedback effects.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger part, as I said, was due to our assumptions around tax planning, which don't have the negative economic effects because you're avoiding the tax, but could affect the revenue growth over time. But yes, we try to build. That's the computable general equilibrium model. Will it's an input output model, so it's got all sectors linked. And if one sector reduces employment or reduces its purchases from another sector, then that works through the economy.
Okay. One more follow-up, please.
Yes.
On your slide with net revenue impact, it's interesting that the net revenue in 2017-19 biennium is actually more than the forecast for 21-23. Which is interesting as we talk about generally the economy in the state grows exponentially, you know. Revenue for the state general fund goes up about $2 billion now. Is that due to the economy in the state slowing, number one, or is it just simply that those corporations are adjusting and finding ways to get around the new minimum tax?
Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, both factors attribute to this. You can see that our liability continues to grow, although its rate is slower when we take these secondary effects.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it is about 4-5% growth in gross receipts overall. We think it's going to be more like 2.5% or so when you factor in those other things. Now, there's a third force at work here for 17-19, though. We've only taken about 20% of that 17 liability and assume that's going to be collected in the last 6 months of the year. So typically, when we have a major tax program, we assume there's some startup delays. Department of Revenue has to get geared up. Now, obviously, corporations have incentive to pay. They don't want to get stuck with penalties. But it would take us, you know, a year to get into that normal pattern between when liability occurs and when the Department of Revenue gets the check. So that's some of that 17-19 number is artificially inflated because it has some of those collections that are from the first 6 months in effect. Okay. So, but you're right that the growth is pretty slow out there, and the primary reason for that is this assumption that we think over the first 3 or 4 years of this change, we would see tax planning erode the tax base, and it's especially as we have bigger corporations who have a significant increase in their liability, they'll be looking for ways to avoid the tax, and that's pretty, we would anticipate that to occur based on what we see worldwide from corporations.
Yeah, hopefully we're getting close to the end.
Yeah,
because
just one more, I guess.
We have a bunch of other things to do today. Yeah.
So a slower economy is going to provide fewer new job opportunities. That's a given. And I guess as I think about, if I was a college student, even a high school student, thinking, looking forward, I'm going to have fewer job opportunities out there, but the cost of my education is also going to go up significantly perhaps too, as you factor in all these other cost drivers from energy to food to everything else in terms of what a cost of a degree is going to be like. So not a very rosy picture, I guess, for our younger generation, but my two bits. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I think it's interesting to note that we're not talking about job losses. We're talking about a decrease in the rate of growth. None of these charts suggest that we're going to lay anybody off as a result of this, although, of course, in specific places it might happen.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. I mean, we have employment reductions in employment growth. The one sector where we think is the most vulnerable is the wholesale trade sector, where there's not a lot of job growth projected, mm-hmm. and our adjustments put that pretty much to flat.
Okay.
So, and that's where we would be concerned about a locational adjustments. If you're a distributor, can you distribute to the same customers by being located outside the state and avoiding that second transaction?
And you were careful to point out that this report deals almost entirely with, except for some general statements about public sector employment, almost entirely with the effect of the tax on the private sector. What kind of astounds me in a way is that we're dealing with a tax which is the order of magnitude, as you pointed out, of Measure 5, which significantly cuts support for schools and local governments because of the cuts in the property tax. This measure essentially has the capacity, at least, to replace those losses from a different group of people, not from homeowners and property tax business payers, but the largest corporate sales businesses in Oregon. And yet, the numbers that you're talking about in terms of the effect on even the private sector are pretty modest. And as I think you pointed out, considerably smaller than the effects we expect just in the normal course of the economy. Are those fair statements?
I think that's correct, Mr. Chair. I think as you pointed out, really the forecast going forward, there'll be other factors that'll have a bigger effect proportionally in all likelihood. And again, what we're looking at is a situation where we think that there will be responses to the tax change. It's big enough, and we'll see the wage and price responses we built in. But those will be in the context of the broader economy, and the proportions will not be big.
Right. Thank you. And, of course, I think you also pointed out, you certainly did this morning, that you have not taken into account the long-term effects of a public school system that actually functions, where our dropout rate significantly declines because we're able to fund it properly, the better health care for our citizens and better care for seniors. I think you indicated that those positive impacts you were unable to describe in your report.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We didn't incorporate those longer-term impacts really because of measurement issues and timing issues. But there is the potential if those investments, anything that increases the productivity of labor or capital will increase the capacity of the economy and potentially its growth over time. So, yes, those kinds of things would be why we listed them as an upside risk. And I think it's...
Upside risk is economies for things might be better.
Does better than we're forecasting, than we're anticipating. Yes, it's a good thing.
All right.
But, again... I think we're likely to be looking at a longer time horizon for those to truly pay off in measurable economic ways, but it certainly would be consistent with economic theory and what we've seen in other states where education systems end up deteriorating. You definitely see impacts on economic growth over time.
Right. Thank you very much. Thank you. And, of course, we're way over time, and I see we our legislative counsel has been patiently waiting for his turn at the witness table, and I think we'll move on. Thank you. And we heard good things about your presentation this morning, so we expect to be kept awake, at least, by your presentation.
All right, Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and I will do my best to make sure no one drifts off. We're here today to talk about a recent Oregon Supreme Court case, City of Seattle versus Department of Revenue. And I'm here, by the way, with Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel, Kate Toswell. She's going to talk about the specifics of the case, but let me just kind of lay out the framework of what we're talking about. And as I think you all know, the Oregon Constitution has, from the beginning of statehood, had a provision in it that required, quotes, bills for raising revenue to originate in the House. And about 20 years ago, in 1995, that phrase was, the Constitution was amended, and that phrase was used in a different way as well when first the Legislative Assembly referred to voters and then voters approved in 1995. The requirement that bills for raising revenue be passed by a 3/5 majority in each chamber in order to become law. And we have, since the 1995 amendment, the legislature has directed our office to identify what we believe are bills for raising revenue and to identify in the title of the bill that's what it is, and then it requires a 3/5 vote for passage. And that is that particular procedure, putting that in the title of the bill, that's not a constitutional requirement. That's something that you have asked us to do. And one of the effects of that has been that it has become very difficult for the Supreme Court or courts generally to be able to consider whether a particular proposal is a bill for raising revenue or not. The reason why is when a bill, it's got the tag in the title and it fails to achieve 3/5, it's considered dead, will never then be litigated. And if the bill obtains the 3/5, then there's no issue, and it, again, will never be litigated. And so there's only been a very narrow set of circumstances under which you're going to get a court case dealing with this issue of what is a bill for raising revenue, and that is where legislative counsel has initially concluded it's not a bill for raising revenue. And then there is enough of a colorable argument out there that there's some litigant that's willing to challenge that. And also, the vote totals fall within that very narrow delineation of being more than a simple majority but less than 3/5, or the bill originates in the Senate, and therefore the issue arises through origination clause violations or claims of origination clause violations. The bill in question in the City of Seattle case involves that origination clause claim, and but we have been told by the courts previously that the standards are the same for origination and three-fifths vote purposes. Okay. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Kate to discuss the details of the case.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Kate Toswell from Office of Legislative Counsel. This case, City of Seattle, involved plaintiffs who were taxpayers that were out-of-state municipal corporations, and the questions in the case involved property taxation of electrical facilities used for the transmission, basically portions of the grid, the electrical grid that are within Oregon, and property tax implications of that. And in this case, there were a number of municipal corporations that challenged taxation of that property. There were some arguments that were made in the case that aren't really relevant to the issue of raising revenue, and those had to do with whether the property interests of those taxpayers was sufficient to be taxed because they had certain types of licenses or agreements where they could use the property, and there were questions as to whether earlier cases were correctly decided dealing with that issue. That's not relevant to the question of bills for raising revenue. What is relevant is the origination clause question that was raised in this case and then was ultimately decisive in the holding in this case. Now, in the tax court, the measure that was being challenged, which was a 2009 bill, it was a Senate bill, and in 2009, the legislature removed a exemption for out-of-state, also known as foreign utilities, that had been enacted earlier in 2005. So in 2005, there's an exemption for out-of-state utilities, electrical utilities. In 2009, there's a Senate bill, and when it's introduced, initially the purpose of the bill is to remove the exemption, or to extend the exemption to all utilities, including in-state utilities. That bill, which was Senate Bill 495, in 2009, passes the Senate, and it then heads to the House where it's amended. And in its amended version in the House, it removes the exemption for the out-of-state utilities. It passes the House, it goes back to the Senate, and in its enrolled form, it removes the exemption for the out-of-state utilities. And as a result, it has a positive revenue impact. It clearly brings money into the state treasury. We then look at bills for raising revenue under the limited case law that we have, and specifically under the case Bobo versus Kulongoski, which is the leading case, and there's a test that's set up in Bobo. The first part of the test is, does a measure bring money into the state treasury? And at a basic level, that's the first prong of the test. And when we look at Senate Bill 495 in 2009, we can say, yes, it did bring money into the treasury. It had a positive revenue impact. It clearly raised revenue. Under Bobo, we then look at the second prong, which is, does the measure have the essential features of a bill levying a tax? And in this case, when it got to the Oregon Tax Court, the tax court said there is no origination clause problem, because the things that we're concerned about in the origination clause occurred in the House. The bill that was passed by the Senate was not a bill for raising revenue. It was only when it got to the House and was amended in the House that it brought in revenue. So the concerns that we have at the constitutional level are not a problem here, because this House was able to vote on this. It then went back to the Senate and was enrolled. So at the Oregon Tax Court level, this bill was not considered to be an origination clause problem, and the taxpayers, the plaintiffs, did not prevail. Then when the case went to the Oregon Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, well, no, we're going to affirm the lower court. We agree that there isn't a problem, but for a different reason. And what the Oregon Supreme Court said was, although it's bringing money, it clearly has a positive revenue impact, a measurable impact. It's bringing money into the state treasury, but it doesn't have the essential features of a bill levying a tax. And so even though there were taxpayers who were exempt previously and as a result of Senate Bill 495 had a tax burden the tax property tax on the electrical transmission facilities. And what the court said was removing the exemption, the repeal of the exemption is not, you can't equate that with the imposition of a tax. So for those reasons, and this case was decided last September, the Oregon Supreme Court said that this was no, we would no longer consider this to be a bill for raising revenue. And because the same analysis plot applies for origination clause and for supermajority questions, this would not need to be, this could have a simple majority, a bill that removes a tax exemption. And so essentially that is the holding, and that's, we now have that piece of case law interpreting the second prong of the Bobo case.
So to follow on to what Kate said, we now think, based on the this Seattle case, that our analysis within legislative council will change somewhat in certain ways, both that will be different at the state level and for local taxes. So let me lay out our thinking here. A tax, in its essence, it always involves two things, a tax rate and a tax base. And we have, for the 20 years or so that the three-fifths vote has been around, we have considered that if the principal purpose of the legislature in either increasing the tax rate or modifying the tax base to bring in more revenue, if that was the principal purpose, that was a bill for raising revenue. Based on the City of Seattle case, we're going to revise our thinking and consider bills for raising revenue to only be those that change the tax rate piece of it. So, for example, an income tax subtraction, if you were to repeal that going forward after the City of Seattle case, we believe the correct analysis, even though it may raise a significant amount of money, we believe the correct analysis is that that is not a bill for raising revenue because it does not have the essential features of a tax, which is the tax rate side, not changes to the tax base. And so that would not be a bill for raising revenue in our view. Another example, this is a little bit further out there where it's not quite as clear, but I still think this is the correct result, would be, say, the repeal or reduction of an income tax credit. Historically, that too would be considered a bill for raising revenue. But there are cases out there that describe a tax credit as a matter of legislative grace, as something that occurs, that changes after the tax liability has been arrived at, and because that is not a modification of that would under Seattle not be a imposition of a tax in a strict sense, because it does not change the tax rate. We would, our opinion is that that would also not be a bill for raising revenue, whereas it would have prior to this case. By contrast, the case may have also changed our views on local government taxes. That is less clear, but let me go back to the property tax exemption that the case dealt with. Without any real analysis, the court said it clearly brings revenue into public coffers when you repeal an exemption. That is actually not how the property tax system works, however. When the legislature makes a change to, say, repeal an exemption, the next step in that process is for independently elected governing bodies at the local level to determine what tax rates they are going to impose for the next year. And you all recall from Measure 50 that it established permanent rate limits, and they are often referred to by shorthand as permanent rates, but they are in fact limits. And there is nothing that prohibits a local government from deciding to impose a rate that is less than the maximum limit established by Measure 50. My point here is that the court, without any real analysis, assumed that a property tax exemption was automatically would bring revenue into public coffers. And that is not our reasoning in that. And because they are assuming that, there is perhaps an argument that any legislation that you enact at the state level that merely authorizes a local government to impose a tax, or that merely changes the base in such a way but nevertheless preserves the local government's abilities to make a subsequent decision where there's actual revenue that may come in, that could be a bill for raising revenue. I think that's a stretch, but again, it's not inconsistent with the Seattle case to come to that conclusion. Finally, the only other comments that I want to make concern, I mentioned at the beginning that there are very few cases on this, and the reason is because of the procedures that you have us engage in to identify it in the title of the bill. This case has led to some uncertainty, and we have always been cautious in this area in order to avoid the state unconstitutionally collecting a tax for a long time, and then by the time the issue is litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court, years, maybe even a decade goes by, the court says it's unconstitutional, and then there's this very huge liability that must be refunded to taxpayers. And I think this case increases the uncertainty. So there is something you may wish to consider that would reduce that risk, and that would be to, by statute, create some kind of a special cause of action that must be used to challenge a new legislation on bill for raising revenue grounds with a very short statute of limitations, so that litigants would have to make the claim fairly promptly, and an expedited process for expedited review by the Supreme Court until there is more certainty. So with that, those are my comments, and Kate's comments. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Have you drafted that bill yet?
No, Mr. Chair. I'm waiting for
a request. Thank you. Questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks very much for your testimony. Looking at the text of the case, I note that the court quotes Bobo on page 736 as saying, the revenue effect of a bill in and of itself does not determine if the bill is a bill for raising revenue. But that statement to me also implies that if it is the intent of raising revenue in a bill, simply because a bill only affects a tax base and not a tax rate, that it could be a bill for raising revenue. Because I think we can go to the extreme, the implication being looking at our tax expenditure report, for example, that we completely remove the exemption or the subtraction for charitable giving, which would be an effective tax increase to, in the orders of, I think, hundreds of millions of dollars in Oregon. It's hard to argue that going through the process, at least one of the legislative intents in doing that would not be to raise revenue. Otherwise, why would we be taking that action? I guess my question to you is, the intent of the legislature in raising revenue no longer relevant, or is it only those two factors?
Chair Bernhardt, Representative Davis, the court did not overturn the Bobo case, so the two-prong test is still there. That two-prong test being, one, does it bring revenue in, and two, does it have the essential features of a tax? But it provides guidance on what those essential features are. And so I think What it makes clear is that changes in the base are themselves not, even if that's what the purpose under the Seattle case, in my view, what the Seattle case stands for is that the fact that a bill brings in revenue does not itself manifest the purpose of the legislature in doing whatever it's doing, and that it still has to have the essential features of a tax, and that is changes on the rate side, not just on the base side. So, for example, a brand new tax, no question, that would be a bill for raising revenue too, but that's both rate and base.
And follow up. Now, I guess maybe you confirmed what I disagree with, which is 736, again, the court says the revenue effect of a bill in and of itself does not determine if the bill is a bill for raising revenue. Well, if the legislature expressly intends that a change in the base or a change in a subtraction or a tax credit is for the purpose of raising revenue, and that expression of intent is made clear in the legislative proceedings in committee and on the floor by those who potentially vote in favor of the bill, does that not come into the analysis of whether or not the bill has the essential elements of that which raises revenue? So is intent no longer part of the analysis?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, it probably is an area of disagreement.
Hence the cause of action might be helpful.
Listen to the lawyers argue, yes.
I think the essential features of a bill levying a tax, what they were looking for was, again, more than purpose, but something that modified the rate side of the equation.
Mr. Chair?
One question.
Are you finished, Representative Davis?
Yeah,
Representative Nels?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm tempted to riff on Representative Davis's question, but I'm going to hold back.
Go for it.
Good idea.
I would love you to.
My question is more basic. Could you say it again for the non-lawyer on this panel? I think I'm one. There's two of us. Three, maybe. You're not a lawyer either. You said we have to do a court, pass a bill so it goes to the courts. Can you explain that a different way? That went over my head.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nos, first of all, I didn't say that there is anything that had to be done.
Okay. You suggested. Sorry. I use more precise language.
Something you may consider.
Okay.
Would be a way to get these issues before the court more promptly, there isn't a huge liability that is accumulating over time that then ultimately needs to be refunded. And this case is a good example. This was a 2009 legislation and it was only decided a couple of months ago.
Right. Can I just follow up? So
yes, please.
Okay. So just hang with me for a minute. What does that mean? Like, I would say, let's pass a little teeny tiny tax increase on somebody and see if they take us to court, and then we can expound further on what Representative Davis was kind of going after. I mean, like, is that what you mean?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nos, no.
Okay.
It is what I mean would be in a bill that hasn't, you know, doesn't have anything really substantively to do with taxes, there would be a provisions that allow for a special cause of action to be brought, that is to say a claim by an interested party that allows it to go up to the Supreme Court very quickly, and that there's a very narrow window so that this issue isn't hanging out for years while a litigant shows up. There's a narrow window.
And the claim is waived if you don't follow this process.
Correct. It's a standard statute of limitations kind of process.
So who?
Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who would bring that before the court, or would it just bring itself?
No.
There would be a party opposed to, typically a taxpayer or
somebody who has to pay the tax.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. And I think the most recent example would be the special session legislation of 2013 related to the public employee retirement system, which provided a direct appeal to the Supreme Court, and that decision was expedited, I think, in maybe 14 months, something in that period of time.
Yes.
We've done that many times in connection with things like ballot titles or things like the Peirce bill. This is a more general statute, though, that you're talking about, where it would establish a special statute of limitations and a special precedent for the appeal process in a case in which this particular claim was made.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. So it would be more of a general one that was tied to, I believe, particular legislation.
Yes, correct.
Good point.
Yeah. And that way, that deals with the problem of facing potentially gigantic liability a decade out, because anybody who doesn't bring this lawsuit at the right time has waived their claim.
That's correct.
On that basis, at
least.
Yeah. Anything else? That was an expeditious explanation. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Colleagues, because of the lateness of the hour, we're going to switch the order of the next two items and ask for the updating of school formula poverty data first. Next. No, we're going to skip the last item. Gentlemen, thank you so much for waiting around for us.
Of course. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Wilfong. I'm the Director of School Finance and School Facilities. We're here today to discuss the recent update to the poverty in the state school fund. I think that we'll start with a little bit of history with the poverty, kind of give an idea, understanding why we're with the recent update and why there may be a little bit of concern with that. Prior to fiscal year 2013, we used the decennial census data. And for the districts that had less than 2,500 ADMR, we also coupled that with the free and reduced lunch data. And that, with the decennial census data, again, that was...
Hey, did you want to interrupt? Is there something
that... Do you want to use presentation file?
The presentation file, okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we'll bring that up. Let me indicate why it was that I asked to have this particular presentation done, and I suspect you know this, but just to establish a context for the committee, it was my understanding that the update was made at a time and in a way that had an effect on current budgets. And the result of that was that some school districts were faced with a situation in which their budget in the middle of the school year ended up being smaller than they expected it to be, and other districts in the middle of the same school year found that their budgets were larger than they were expected to be. And I think you may want to talk about other things as well, but if you would direct some of your remarks at least to that concern and how we might deal with that so that we don't put school districts in a bind trying to figure out how to adjust a budget in the middle of the year because of some requirement that you have to make adjustments in the middle of the school year.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, for that context. Let me just a little bit more with the history. And so, with using the decennial census data, it was 10 years between updates. And so, the mandate from the legislature was that we wanted to use one census data, and we wanted to have accurate data because we didn't want to see, with the most recent update, a 13-year span between updates and the poverty. As we both all know, we had two major recessions during the last decade. And so accurate data was the most important piece of that. When we initially wrote the rule in the department for how to update the poverty, we, during the almost 30-month lifespan of the state school fund from beginning to end, we were updating it three times, which is very similar to how we update all other data within the state school fund. We start with an estimate. We go to basically updating with the mid-year, and then we reconcile with the actuals data. And that span takes about roughly 30 months. So actually updating in the middle year is a common practice with the state school fund. We're rolling in, for example, average daily membership with student attendance, special education updates, a number of factors that we're updating with the state school fund. It's a moving target at all times. Probably the concern is that with the poverty, this is a relatively new adjustment of the formula. And again, the 2013 session or legislative body gave power to the department to write the rules, and we made those updates starting with the 14-15 school year. And so we've just had two school years to roll in this, use this new formula. Last school year, we didn't see as much change. However, with the economy improving, in fact, with Oregon being one of the fastest recovering economies in the market, it didn't come as a great surprise to me that we were going to see a reduction in poverty around the state. Albeit I am very sympathetic to those schools, but it's that money doesn't necessarily just disappear. Yes, we're pulling it away from certain districts or giving to other districts that are in more need with more accurate information. But even as a state, if we reduce the overall amount of weights, that funding actually increases the general education portion of the weight. And so, again, we're just simply redirecting that. But updating it, the state school fund with estimates in the mid-year is a fairly common practice. Some school districts were hit a little bit harder than other school districts because, again, they were in counties, for example, Lane County, that clearly is having a higher recovery than some. Moving forward, we met with the COSA group, and we talked with the superintendents. We asked, first and foremost, are we using the correct data? All agreed with that. They asked about potential for making any changes. There was a recommendation that we put together in a work group to review that. My thinking there was that we would look at the data, look at if we were to update it just one time during the life cycle of the state school fund. Possibly that would be create more predictability and stability in the funding formula. But keep in mind when we're updating less frequently, we're increasing the span with which the time to make those updates. And again, for example, with the 15-16 school year, we just made an update with the data in from December of 15. That data is actually from fiscal year 14. By the time we finally reconcile the 15-16 school year in May of 17, that data will be 4 years apart. And as we all know, most recessions don't last much longer than 2 to 3 years. So trying to drive accurate information, getting those districts that are in need, right now as we're coming out of the economy, yes, it has a negative impact because we're reducing the weights. However, if we have a step down in the economy, we're going to have just the opposite problem with the situation, is where those districts that are needing those poverty weights, it's going to be 4 years before we can finally get the data to them if we try to increase the stability and predictability of the state school fund. We were trying to find that, if you will, lack of a better phrase, that Goldilocks formula that gets accurate information, but yet it's relatively stable and predictable. We thought we had that, and I think for the most part, the state's pretty good. However, again, Lane County was hit a little bit harder than the rest of the state. And I'll turn it over to Michael Elliott here. Michael Elliott, to my right, is the state school fund, or excuse me, the school facilities coordinator, but he was also the state school fund coordinator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Elliott, school facilities coordinator for Department of Education. I want to turn your attention to the screen and show you two case studies. These are actual districts and what happened with poverty and what happened with all their weights. And this is to underscore what Mr. Wiltfong was talking about and addressing Chair Barnhart's question about these mid-year adjustments and how it impacts budgets. So this first case study shows all of the weights for that district and how each weight changed moving from December of 2015 to April 2016. And the reason why I picked those two dates is because the December 2015 was projected data, if you will. It was based on district estimates. It was based on a couple year old data for some of the weights, but it was the best we had at the time. By April 2016, we had second period average daily membership data, so that was better, and that was rolled in, and we had better special ed data, better EL data, better pregnant parenting data, and more recent poverty data. And as you can see, yes, poverty did have a significant drop, but because of all the other weight shifts, it wasn't as significant as initially projected. It only lost 47 weights on a 12,000 weight district, as opposed to the poverty weight dropping of 129. So districts do have some history with changes in the mid-year. The second case study, this district actually had a poverty weight increase from the December to the April estimates. But as you can see, because some of their other estimates were off, some of the other projections were off, they also saw a weight decrease. So again, districts are used to, at a big level, they're used to being able to, they're used to these changes. And so that's why the mid-year was chosen. And like Mr. Wiltfong was saying, there is that tension between predictability, stability. If we update once, then districts will have that same update every all throughout the 30 months of the life cycle of that year's state school fund. But again, it's going to be 3-4 years apart, and we could end up seeing something like this, where the poverty data year is showing the economy in relative health, but the current year, the economy is in not relative health, mm-hmm. so the weights are off, because everybody's like, I've got more poverty, I've lost jobs, where's the increase in weights? Well, the increase is lagging behind. You won't see it for a couple of years until we update the data. And so that's the tension we're working through and talking with the school districts about how best to serve the school districts, but also further the intention of the legislature, which was to get better, accurate data more quickly into the state school fund formula.
Questions? I guess the one for me is I looked at the school district data, and there were some significant swings. I mean, millions of dollars in mm-hmm. some school districts, both positive and negative, in the middle of the school year or toward the end of the school year. And you have a situation where the realistic situation is that the school districts that are getting less money have already spent it. The school districts that are getting more money haven't spent it, and they'll carry it over till the next year, probably. And of course, I'm very aware of the fact that a school budget is open until the next May. A budget that ends in June of this year will still be open, as far as you're concerned, at least until May of 17. So the final on a budget is, or at least on an allocation, is a year out. But I'm concerned about a change that leads to multi-million-dollar swings at a time when people are unable to respond to it. Either by hiring more staff in order to take care of an additional poverty that you've discovered, or on the other hand, recouping money that they've already spent, which of course isn't possible.
Right.
Thoughts about how to ameliorate that?
I do, Chair Bernhardt. Excellent question. Thank you. Again, I share the concerns of a number of school districts that saw the reductions across the state. When Michael and I were designing the formula, we knew that there would be at least the safety net with the extended ADMW in the state school fund. And there's, as we allude to, there's a number of hydraulics. You know, there's updates in ADM, there's EL, what have you, during the school year. But again, that the extended ADMW, the district will not fall below the previous year's. And so essentially extended ADMW is we take the larger of either the current year's ADMW or the previous year's ADMW. And we pay up based on the larger of the two. And so when we were designing that, we thought that the extended ADMW would act as a safety net so that we wouldn't see millions and millions of dollars. Yes, for example, Springfield, they did lose a number of weights. However, by the time you filter that through all the hydraulics of everything else is going the mid-year, they ended up, it was roughly, 50 weights overall. So again, it's $350,000, but not to the millions of millions of dollars. So, but yes, we share the concern. We believe that the extended ADMW will minimize, significant drops in the school districts across the state. And we haven't seen the millions of millions. We have seen the changes, but with a multi-billion-dollar budget, millions of dollars is not uncommon when we're making updates mid-year based on second period data. But we are certainly willing to take this, again, form a work group, see if there's a suggestion that would be a little bit more stable.
The number.
We're happy to do that.
I think it might be valuable to involve COSA and the Oregon School Boards Association,
yes,
and actually do that.
Yes.
That work group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Well,
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to fill in, as a school board guy.
I mean, you've been on it more recently than I have.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
I'm just saying it all points out the need for budgetary prudence. And you
correct.
Don't live hand to mouth, and if
correct.
You have corrections during a budget year, you don't go rush out and spend that and buy something because it can just as easily go away. So you budget on an annual basis, and the time you put together your budget, like districts are doing right now, you do it best based on your best projections that you have. They're recognizing there's going to be waffles in the system between now and the end of that budget year. So you don't spend what you don't have, and you don't build sustainable programs around one-time infusions either. But getting back to the initial change, which some of us are still grumbling about, when you impose this new formula, it would have been nice to have a couple-year phase in. because some districts like us, suddenly we had 50 kids that evaporated overnight. That's tough. When you start looking at the weighting formula, but that's all water under the bridge. We're fine. We've all adapted. But other than that, I do think it's great to have the more regularly adjusted information to keep us all current with what's going on in the economy. So
right.
You got a tough job. You can't satisfy everybody.
As a school board member, is the idea of a work group to look at this useful at this stage? What do you think?
It can be, but I think that the system's adapted by and large to where it's at now. And I think
it's a one-time shock.
You might also want to incorporate it with a good friend, Mr. Green, out here in an exercise in boardmanship for school boards, too, so that they, you know, budget prudently and so forth. Yeah. That's a different conversation with what happens with the formula once it gets out of here.
Right. Yeah. And thank you very much for reminding us that it's the phasing in, the lack of phasing in, that I think was the thing that that got everyone's attention.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. And I'd forgotten that point when I made my initial comments. Mm-hmm. Anything else for the, thank you. We appreciate the presentation. I think there's some discomfort with the formula you ended up with. There's certainly some discomfort with the phase in. Perhaps we can have a very brief report back after a while to see where you've come out on this thing. That would be very helpful.
Happy to do that for you, Chair.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And now we'll go back to 3:30. We're only an hour late. Common School Fund, sources, uses of revenue. Mr. Paul.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart. My name is Jim Paul. I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. And I'm going to just spend a little bit of time with you today talking about the Common School Fund, which is different than the State School Fund, obviously. And hopefully by the end of my talk, you all know a little bit more about that. And if you just give me a second to get this to the full screen mode. Okay. So I will be talking about history and the purpose of the fund with you, and then I'll speak a little bit about the revenue sources, and then cover in investments of the fund, and then finally end with information about the distributions to schools. So the history of the Common School Fund. The Common School Fund goes back to statehood, was established at statehood with the purpose of providing funding for public schools. So it originated with the land grant from the federal government of every 16th and 36th section, and it was essentially a promise through Oregon's Admissions Act. Was a promise that by granting Oregon statehood, amongst all the other pieces that come with statehood, one of those pieces was that Oregon would receive every 16th and 36th section to be managed for the purpose of common schools, which at that time was the term for K through 12 schools. Oregon is one of 30 states to receive land under the from the federal government in this way. The first was Ohio in 1802, and it ended with Alaska in 1958. And each state had their own admissions act that was a little mostly the same, but a little bit wording in each. You can imagine over that period of time they didn't remain verbatim throughout that stretch. Today we manage about 20%. We have about 20% of what's left of the original lands granted. So we manage 750,000 acres of common school lands for this purpose. Much of those lands were sold off between statehood and the early 1900s, and which is interesting. Piece of history. That was actually the intent with the admissions acts of the states that came in between 1802 and towards the latter half of the 1800s. The actual intent and expectations was that states would sell these lands to generate capital to build schools, to fund schools. That changed towards the end of the 1800s and end of the 1800s into the 1900s, where those admissions acts were more about holding on to the lands and managing them for long-term revenue. So who manages the Common School Fund? by as set in the Constitution, the State Land Board is the trustee, or as we call the fiduciaries of this fund. The State Land Board is made up of the chair, who is the governor, and the treasurer, and the secretary of state. So three members of the Common School Fund, which makes it quite interesting in terms of avoiding formal public meetings. No two members can ever discuss any issues around the Common School Fund unless we were in a public meeting. The Land Board meets every other month throughout the year. The public schools, of course, K through 12 students are the beneficiaries. And not only are the current students beneficiaries, but future students are beneficiaries. So it's a really interesting, job to be to oversee a department, oversee this sort of purpose. It's not often you get to have to be concerned about intergenerational equity and generations that are yet to be born. But that those are the beneficiaries that the Land Board is entrusted as a fiduciary to make sure that we are doing as much as we can with these lands. For the purpose of those future and current and future students. And the intergenerational equity piece essentially comes down to making sure that we are not managing those lands and the monies from those lands in a way that would favor the current generation over the future, or vice versa, that we're not doing things that would favor the future generations over the current. So revenue sources of the Common School Fund. There are two primary revenue sources that we categorize as constitutionally directed and statutorily directed. Our constitutionally directed sources come from the real property granted at statehood that I just talked a bit about, as well as escheated property, which is our probate. Basically, we also, the Department of State Lands, also manages the probate for the state of Oregon. And then there's statutorily directed programs, which is our waterways programs, which involves regulating the use on state-owned waterways, state-owned navigable waterways, as well as our removal fill programs. That also includes our wetland conservation work and all the regulations around removal fill activity in the state of Oregon. This is a visual diagram to... that represents the various sources of inputs and outputs on the fund. We refer to as our lake diagram. And what you see at the top of that diagram are the primary constitutional revenue, which comes from the land. Of those 750,000 acres, the large majority are rangelands in eastern Oregon. The next in line is forest lands of about 122,000 acres of forest lands. The most well-known piece of forest lands the Common School Fund owns is the Elliott State Forest. About 82,500 acres of trust lands are within the Elliott State Forest. And then we have our statutory revenues. Those revenues all go into the Common School Fund principal, and in that principal is also included unclaimed property receipts. And then out of that, we pay for any capital improvement and maintenance on our lands or our properties. And we also pay for constitutional expenses, unclaimed property expenses, and distributions to schools. So how is all the monies that are made and that make up the Common School Fund outside of the land? So since statehood, all the revenues that have been generated through managing the land and from the constitutional sources have built up what's today is the Common School Fund proper. It's worth about $1.4 billion. And that the management of that fund is directed by the Oregon Investment Council. So that's been delegated to the Oregon Investment Council to manage that fund. They deal with the issues of asset allocation, the various equities and fixed income, and as well as selecting fund managers for managing that fund. The investment division within a treasury does the actual work around the fund itself. They hire consultants, investment professionals. They make recommendations to the Oregon Investment Council. They also handle all the transactions and monitor the portfolio. This chart shows you the growth of the Common School Fund going back to 2004. You can see it generally tracks the trends in the stock market and the economy. You can see the Great Recession there that dipped in 2008, and then it came back and recovered from that. In the last couple of years, we have been up above the $1.4 billion mark. So what happens with this fund in terms of helping to fund common schools. So we make distributions every year. Actually, two distributions a year are made to the public schools budget, and end of December and end of June are the two times we make those distributions. And those are dictated by the land board distribution policy. So the land board decides what level of distributions are appropriate given the performance of fund and the outlook on the fund. In terms of developing that policy and updating it over time, some of the key considerations are making sure, one, the fund is sustainable. In fact, we are charged with not only sustaining it, but growing the fund, continuing to grow the fund over time, even with distributions. And the other piece that's been really important in recent years is the consistency versus volatile amounts. So there used to be wider swings year to year, biennium to biennium, in terms of the distributions, and we've adjusted that policy. The most recent update to the policy was 2009 to try to level those off so there aren't as big enough swings. That's so that the schools can anticipate better and plan better for the funds that they are receiving from those distributions. The current policy is essentially a 4% of the three-year rolling average as of December 31st. So for the calendar year that we are distributing funds, we look back at the three-year rolling average of the Common School Fund. We take 4% of that, and that is what the policy dictates in terms of our distributions. And we send those to the Department of Education twice annually, as I mentioned, end of June and end of December, for further distribution by the Department of Education. And those funds are distributed proportional. They're distributed to all 197 school districts, and it's proportional to the number of students basically in those school districts. And the final graph I'll leave you with here, and then be happy to answer questions, is the history on the actual distributions that the fund has provided to public schools. Going back to 2005, you'll see we were at about $40 million, and it's varied since then. But the last few years, we've been up above $50 million. And the most recent was just a little bit above, or the most, this, for this biennium, we will be distributing more than $50 million each year to help support the public schools budget. And just to wrap up, just a couple of points looking forward, we are actually in the middle of starting to work with the Department of Treasury and their consultants to actually take a look at our distribution policy. It's been about 7 years, which is a typical cycle where we decide it's time to go back and check in and make sure the policy is the right policy, as well as they're looking at the asset allocation right now for us. That work we expect to take a number of months and anticipate coming to the land board sometime in 2017 with potential recommendations and changes of both to the distribution policy if needed, as well as the asset allocation approach. So with that, I will close and be happy to answer any questions any of you might have.
It's all stuff I didn't know. It's interesting.
Questions?
I have a comment.
Yes, please.
I just have one comment. A couple of years ago, somebody contacted me and said, do you know you have money over at the state lands, unclaimed? And I thought that was strange that, and there are several other legislators I've talked to, that you can't find us. So how hard do you try to find the people that you have this money that's come in, I guess, old bank accounts or tax refunds or whatever? I mean, I've had this conversation with more than one legislator that we wonder how hard you really try and find the people, given that there are sitting legislators who have money there that all you have to do is go across the street, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt, appreciate the question. The unclaimed property program, and actually, to your point, I think you said at the beginning there, a little odd, or that Department of State Lands holds those. It's an issue we deal with how is it that unclaimed property ends up in the state lands? It was placed there historically, so we do manage it. And we do actually struggle in terms of communication to let folks know that this is where the unclaimed property of the state of Oregon is. However, we take in about $60 million a year in unclaimed revenues, unclaimed properties.
Is that 60 or 16?
60.
Okay.
60. So you can imagine probably thousands of individuals and records, you know, with tens of thousands probably. So we, the way we approach that is we've actually, over the last few years, we've developed and improved our website to have a very easy lookup tool for folks to go on the website and see very quickly if they have funds or if they potentially have funds. There might be some additional steps to verify that you are that person and if there are more than one types. But and we also have occasionally we do press announcements, or actually the press sort of just says report on themselves to get the word out that we do have this tool, that it is very easy for Oregonians to look up, and then we try to respond as quickly as we can.
I understand. Yeah. So you don't actually try and find the people, then you just accumulate the funds, and it's up to them to try and find the. If they have money, that's...
Let me ask my deputy director of administration is here with me. She oversees that program. Let me have her answer that for you.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Sorry. I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt. Cindy Wickham, Department of State Lands. We actually do what we call an in-house finder service, and we have a subscription with an online web service that can match addresses and sometimes provide new addresses, and we run huge data matches and send letters out to people. There is a dollar threshold at which we do that, and I'm not sure what that is exactly. It may be $250 or $500. So if it's less than that, it's not necessarily cost effective for the agency to do that, because it does take a lot of resources to generate those letters. that's fairly successful. I would also just say I've talked with a lot of legislators over time, and sometimes. Now, I'll go back to Representative Patty Smith. There's a lot of Patty Smiths in Oregon. we get information that's old, like old addresses. We don't necessarily know that it's a legislator. But we're always looking at ways that we can improve our outreach.
Well, in this particular case, the name was unique and the address hadn't changed in 20 years. But it was under $500. And so that probably is your threshold then. It was 400 and some. But somebody from another state called and said, do you know you have money across the street there? And I said, no, I had no idea. So. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Representative Benz.
Thank you. As a total percentage of the work the department does, how much is the land and the school fund part that we just looked at? Is it half of what you do? Is it a third? What's the...
Mr. Chair, Representative, in terms of the number of people, I could talk about in terms of the number of people, we have about 10% of our people on staff work the lands issue, the trust lands, although we have a fiscal staff and an administrative division that's dispersed across all of our programs, and those numbers of those staff are, you know, probably in the around 30. Significant portion of those do both support our lands work as well as making sure we have annual audits on the Common School Fund and making sure we are keeping track of the fund itself.
Yeah, please.
You know, the reason I ask is in the discussions I've had with all of us here about the Elliott over the past years, the issue has been whether or not that particular means of supporting our schools made sense any longer. And I was just curious. I know the department has a broad array of things that it does, and I was just wondering how much of our budget is spent on that aspect of it. Important, and it's $1 billion, so goodness gracious, we don't want it to go anywhere, but that Elliott situation does certainly reflect the change in what we use to fund our schools.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
I mean, the question, there's a question there somewhere. It really is. Do you have an alternative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz,
pick anything.
I can
pick a word.
So historically, prior to about 3 years ago, the level we were spending on managing the Elliott was significantly below what we were generating off of the Elliott. The Elliott, while it makes only about 82,000 acres of the 750, was generating 70 to 80% of all of our revenues off of our land management up until a few years ago. Since 2013, it is now losing money and has lost about $4 million cumulatively since then. And our efforts right now in terms of our expenditures on those particular lands are really in the context of looking at a potential transfer of ownership to move those lands out of the ownership of the Common School Fund. Because of a lengthy public process we began in the spring of 2014 that culminated in a land board decision last August that has us now on a path potentially by the end of this year to entertain proposals to transfer the ownership to another entity so that we can then take convert that asset and invest it in other invest it otherwise that would then be more beneficial to the fund.
The follow-up is, yeah, what's the otherwise?
Mr. Chair, Representative, in this particular case, under the direction of the land board in their action in August, it is to deposit those funds directly into the Common School Fund.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Thank you so much, and we appreciate your sticking around to hear, to present to us today.
So you're very welcome.
Very, very helpful. Appreciate it. Our last item is this one. Should we hold it over till next time? More than just a couple minutes.
Right.
Okay, we're gonna hold the last item over to another meeting. The update on the nonprofit property tax work group. One of the members isn't here. Paul, you obviously have something. Go ahead.
I have an agenda issue to remind the committee.
Please go.
Just to remind you that the forecast release will be next Friday, June 3rd.
Yes.
So that will just be an 8:30 to 10 meeting for the June revenue, economic revenue forecast. It will be jointly with the Senate Finance and Finance Committee. And those, like you, Mr. Chair, and I know the Vice Chair will be gone, but we'll have the Task Force for Reserve Funds will be following that at 10:30.
Yes, and that's a separate meeting.
That's
We will hold this report over until our next regular legislative days meeting. But the point of the meeting next week is that this is in the cycle of the state economist, not our cycle. And so that takes us out of the legislative days. And you should expect this committee will meet at least one more time
in August
when there is no legislative days in order to receive a report from the state economist. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The forecast is actually out later than normal, so there's not an August meeting, but it's about a week prior to the legislative days in September.
Oh. Right, so it's a week after this time and a week before next time.
So it averages out.
So be aware. Hope to see you all here. Hope the podium is full. And is there anything else for us today?
Do we get a reward for all us hanger-oners here?
The reward is that you get 12 minutes of time that is not scheduled. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Two of them aren't even going to be back.